Poetry is the prince of the literary arts, you know? It's at the very top because it's language refined to its apex of memorability. And so I'm interested in poetry as memorability and poetry as something you live by. These words stay in your brain and guide your life. My memoir slash autofiction is called Borges and Me. And it's a story of my time in 1970 when my best friend Billy was drafted for the Vietnam War. And so was I. So he went to Vietnam and I went to Scotland to hide out and to do my graduate work. Altogether, I spent nearly 7 years in Scotland. And so it was during that time that Billy was killed in Vietnam. And I was a nervous wreck. And my memoir talks about my depression, my anxieties. And then I, through my friend Alistair Reed, I met the great Argentine writer Borges. And we went on a little road trip through the highlands. And this kind of conversation with Borges really restored me back to myself and what was important in life. And I felt like that I owed a huge amount to that contact with Borges. And then I was lucky that suddenly out of nowhere came a really wonderful director-producer called Mark Turteltaub. He had read my book and loved it. And he approached me and he said, look, I want to make this movie. And off we went.
Jay Perini, welcome to the creative process.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a real pleasure today to welcome a writer whose voice has been a guiding force in American letters for decades. Jay Perini is the author of acclaimed biographies of literary giants like John Steinbeck, Robert Frost, William Faulkner, and Gore Vidal, as well as, well, there's Borges and Me, which is kind of midway between a biography and autofiction, I think you call it. And also you wrote an illuminating portrait of Jesus in the human face of God. He's also a celebrated poet, novelist, essayist, and teacher. And his work reflects a lifelong devotion to the arts, the humanities, and the power of language to tell the truth gently. From his poetry to his prose, Jay's writing brings rare insights and deep compassion to the page. And he doesn't just study his subjects, he inhabits them. This is the result of long friendships, like over 30 years, I think, with Gore Vidal. And he helps us hear their voices and see the world through their eyes. And of course, he's one of the very few people who can say they've gotten into the heads of both Jesus and Gore Vidal and lived to tell. Well, welcome, Jay. It's an honor to have you with us.
Glad to be here. Anything you'd like to talk about, I'm happy to talk.
Well, yeah, I think you often delve into the complexities of human nature, societal injustices, and Steinbeck's work. And you go into his portrayal of characters like Tom Joad or George and Lenny of Mice and Men. I know that that was kind of commissioned in a way. That was the first of your biographies, is that right?
Yes, it was commissioned. I didn't actually think of it myself, but I love the idea when it was proposed to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that brought you on this journey. And I think it's kind of unusual that you do these biographies and novels and poetry. It's a lot of different modes of writing. But that opened up, I'm not sure of the chronology of your biographies. And now you've just come back from Scotland.
That's right. Yeah. I was in Scotland for almost 3 months.
Tell us a little bit about that. Because that's another mode of writing that's bringing a book that you wrote to the screen, right?
Well, yes, my memoir slash autofiction is called Borges and Me. And as you know, it's a story of my time in 1970 when my best friend Billy was drafted for the Vietnam War. And so was I. So he went to Vietnam and I went to Scotland to hide out and to do my graduate work. Altogether, I spent nearly 7 years in Scotland. And so it was during that time that Billy was killed in Vietnam. And I was a nervous wreck. And my memoir talks about my depression, my anxieties. And then I, through my friend Alistair Reed, I met the great Argentine writer Borges. And we went on a little road trip through the highlands. And this conversation with Borges really restored me back to myself and what was important in life. And I felt like that I owed a huge amount to that contact with Borges. And so very lucky that I was trying to make a film for some time with a couple of English friends. It's incredibly difficult to raise money for a movie these days. I'd say for a movie like Borges and Me, it's virtually impossible to raise money. And then I was lucky that suddenly out of nowhere came a really wonderful director-producer called Mark Turteltaub. He had read my book and loved it. And he approached me and we had a conversation. He said, look, I want to make this movie. And off we went. Once Mark came on board, it was pretty quick. And so we met in Scotland last September, And I was on the set every single day. I had a flat in Glasgow, and we had 61 different sets for the movie. And every single day I would get up at 5 in the morning or 6 and take off to somewhere in Scotland where I would meet up with the crew, which was often 100 people or more. And we would shoot for the day for 8 or 9 hours. And then I would get home to my flat in Glasgow late, and I'd be sent the dailies, and I'd go through all the daily rushes of what we had shot that day and bring my thoughts back the next day to the set. And so I worked very, very closely with the director. I was executive producer, and I'd been involved in a script development for some years. And, you know, I was very closely involved in this at every step of the way. Mark joked to me, he said, now you're ready to direct a movie by yourself if you want to. Generally speaking, it takes about 7 years from the writing of a book to the film. That's what people tell me. And it was about 7 years exactly with Borges. From the time I wrote the book in 2018, I finished it. And we just finished the film here in 2025. We're ready to roll. So that's about almost 7 years exactly. Now, the book appeared in 1990, and I had a call from Anthony Quinn, Zorba the Greek, asking me if I was interested in making a movie of it, and he would play Tolstoy. And I said yes. And so he and I wrote the original version of the script together. It took us 10 years, and finally Tony was ready to make the movie, and he died. And that left me without anybody. And so my producer at the time was a woman called Bonnie Arnold. She had done Dances with Wolves and other films. And I said, please, Bonnie, don't desert me. Hang in there. She said, well, it's not going to be easy, but we'll try. Over the next 10 years, we finally managed to connect with another director and screenwriter who wanted to take it over. And he did, Michael Hoffman. Actually, we thought it was going to be Meryl Streep and Anthony Hopkins. For the longest time, they agreed to play Tolstoy and Mrs. Tolstoy. And then Meryl Streep, for one reason or another, had to drop out fairly close to when we were ready to shoot. And then Anthony Hopkins dropped out. So I thought, oh no, this thing's going to fall apart once again. And by chance, Helen Mirren was in the office of her agent and saw the script. And she read it and she said, I'll do that. I'll play. I'm part Russian. I'll play Sophia Tolstoy. And she said, but I only do if we can get my friend Chris Plummer to play Tolstoy. And then Plummer looked at the project and said, yes, he would do it. So making movies is a scary business. It's almost impossible to do. The film is finished, and so now we're showing it to various festivals, and we're going to see where we'll debut. But in the next 6-7 months, it should come out. And Scotland is really the star of the movie. It is so sumptuously filmed. It's so beautiful driving through the Cairngorm Mountains, rowing on a boat on Loch Ness, going up to Orkney. It's all gloriously filmed and beautiful. So I think that Scotland is the main star of this particular film, which Mark Turtletop did a brilliant job on this film.
And I think it's so interesting because it's also a coming of age for you as a young writer, and you're meant to be leading the blind, the sighted, leading the blind.
Yes.
Through the labyrinths, let us say, through the labyrinths of Scotland, you know, all their famous stone roads that go off for endless spirals into fields. But he's also leading you into the labyrinths of his imagination. And you should say, at the time, you didn't really know who Borges was. So I guess it took you time to distill his wisdom, like to learn who he was after you had met the man, you met the work, which is a little bit of a reversal. And then I'm sure that these lessons that you didn't realize you'd turn into a book, you know, they just resonated and were many decades in the forming.
Yeah, no, for decades and decades, I thought about Borges and what he said to me and the things that were important that he taught me about being a writer. Borges would always say, remember, it's never about you. It's only about the work. And he said, never lose sight of the work. He said, it's the poem, it's the novel that's just trying to emerge. It's the essay. Borges was the master of moving between genres. He did essays that were stories. He did stories that were essays. You know, literary criticism was always part of everything he wrote. Borges said to me that it's more important to be a reader than a writer. He said, really, great readers are rare. Great writers, there are a dime a dozen. Great readers are very, very rare. And he was the greatest of readers, Jorge Luis Borges. Actually, no, I don't ever give lectures from lecture notes. I rarely do. I mean, yeah, if I'm giving a big public occasion speech, I'll read from a typescript. 2 weeks ago, I gave the commencement address at Lehigh University. And there, I, of course, was obliged to read from a script because I didn't want to make it up as I went along because I had a very specific occasion I was working toward. If I'm teaching poetry that I know by heart, I pretty much just talk. I can talk about the poem. I always wanted to write a book about Frost. And when I first started teaching in 1975, it was at Dartmouth College. And my office was right next to the rare books room. They had a collection of 200 and some notebooks by Frost and hundreds of letters and rough drafts of poems. So I began reading and thinking. It turned out lots of Frost's old friends lived around Hanover and in Vermont, and I began one by one to meet people. I think in the end of the day, I spoke to over 200 people that had known Frost and took notes on my conversations. It took me 25 years to write that book because I would stop and do another book, and I would then go back to it. I didn't feel any urgency. I just wanted to complete it at some point.
Well, it's interesting because some of these authors are really teachers in some ways. I understand also Gore Vidal, who you had a friendship of over 30 years, would, I guess, be a kind of mentor. I mean, I was just fascinated how you could actually kind of get under his skin because we know he's brilliant, but I wondered how you navigated that. But I'm just wondering, these are all different teachers. Even Jesus, I mean, he's a great teacher for humanity, but these are all different kinds of teachers. But tell us first about Gore Vidal and how it was to get into that carapace and into that mind.
Well, there was a strange man, a wonderfully brilliant guy, heavily narcissistic. The narcissism was finally debilitating. I think ultimately he would have been up there with Tolstoy and Steinbeck himself had he not been so afflicted with his narcissism. So everything came back to him and how the world was viewing him. And he was too obsessed with himself, and that finally killed the work. It was kind of sad to be with Gore. But also, I learned a lot from him. He had an immensely fertile mind, and he was deeply, deeply knowledgeable. And he was a witty man, and our conversations were tremendously interesting. I couldn't resist writing about him after knowing him as a friend for 30 years and having in my head 1,000 conversations and admiring. I think his best work is his essays. That's where he's at his very best. He wrote 25 novels, but very few of them are of the highest level. They're good, but they're not great. I just think they don't seem to last in the way that, say, Anna Karenina or War and Peace last. How few writers ever achieve anything like that? That's very, very rare, almost unreachable. So Gore's greatest work is probably in his essays, and maybe his greatest work was in his conversation. I mean, he was a great conversationalist.
Talk about narcissism or ego. Again,
wild too.
Achilles Hill.
Achilles Hill brings them down in the end.
You know, there's one thing I agree about the essays, because I think you really hear his voice, and I can imagine what it might have been like to be his friend. And I think sometimes with the novels, because they were so tied usually to a kind of a political, you need to have that political knowledge of the time.
Yes.
So it does date it in some ways if you don't have that knowledge. You know, I read one thing and perhaps, and I thought it was so interesting. So you would have known, I don't know if it was his lifelong partner or whatever, but were they not intimate physically, or they did never kissed or something? But I remember reading that, and maybe this is wrong, but I thought it was so interesting that they kissed in the end. Like they had, before he was going to pass, they kissed. And I thought they'd saved that tenderness until just before. Like it was so precious.
I think when they first met in the 1940s, they had a brief moment of physical affection, very brief. And then it quickly became a friendship. And they were companions and not lovers. And they were never lovers at the end, but certainly at the end, it was almost like they'd returned to be lovers. I mean, not so much romantically kissing, but just affectionate. And Gore really loved Howard, and Howard loved Gore. And it was in some ways a rather beautiful relationship.
I mean, truly what the sense is that the love of your life or someone, you know?
Yeah.
I just thought that was so beautiful and so unusual.
Yes, it was unusual. I think it's not that unknown in a gay world. You see a lot of people who are just companions, you know? And I think that's not unheard of, especially in the 50s and 60s.
And so interesting to be let into that world in Ravello, I guess. And I don't want to just focus on the people that you've met, but this is a really, you know, you're a writer who's lived a life. Some writers are just so often behind the desk, brilliant, but they didn't get out there. I mean, if I just Graham Greene, or just through your biographies and Edward Albee or old Kurt Vonnegut, or, you know, all these others, it's not just the main focus of the biography.
I've been very lucky, and I love conversations, and I've never held back. I've been fortunate to meet lots of people and have great conversations, wonderful people. some of them famous, most of them not, but I've had great conversations in my life.
That reminds me also of Robert Frost, who got inspiration as a chicken farmer and listening to the people, you know, like the stuff of life itself.
Frost didn't become a poet till he was 40 years old. And he would every day and go down to the country store and sit around the wood stove and talk to the other chicken farmers and hear stories. And he learned, he said it was important to hear the sound of sense and hear the common voice, how people talked. And he was able to turn this ordinary speech into poetry, right? That's what he did. And the stories of these common folks, you know, Death of a Hired Man, The Hill Wife, all these wonderful poems, they're all just local stories that he heard around a wood stove, and they became poems. Frost was still, for me, a kind of a guiding light. I love Frost. I try for common sense. I try not to be highfalutin or too theoretical in my work. I try to keep it on a very human. Well, I am working on a book on Camus right now. So that's why last summer I was in Algeria. I was visiting, that was my second trip to Algeria, visiting the birthplace and the home and areas and university areas where Camus worked and lived in the 20s and 30s. I've written about 80% of it in rough draft. It's called The Boy Who Loved Camus. It's about how I was, as a 15-year-old, was avidly reading over and over The Stranger by Camus. And my mother said to me, Jay, you keep reading this book, The Stranger, what's it about? And I said, well, it's about a guy whose mother dies and he doesn't care. And he's essentially condemned to death because they think he doesn't care that his mother died. And she turned to me and she said, Jay, that's absolute filth that you would be reading such a book about a guy who doesn't love his mother. And she said, I'm going to tell your father what you're reading. And that night, my father came into my bedroom and he sat on the edge of my bed. Your mother tells me you're reading this terrible book. And I know boys of 15 often read things they shouldn't read, but you know, it would be wise to keep it hidden under your mattress.
And that is a book that really, I think that when we're lucky to find it when we're young, it's just fascinating. I think that also the books of Dostoevsky or Hermann Hesse, they incite this curiosity and awaken, oh, I didn't know people wrote or thought about this. And then it's interesting because I haven't revisited Camus in many years. And so I wonder what that's like. You know, revisiting.
Last year, all of Camus again. It was amazing to go back to him. He's a brilliant writer. I just retired 2 weeks ago from teaching because I figured, well, I'd done it for 50 years, and it's not as though I didn't give it a shot. I want to spend some time now as I get older focusing on my work.
Yeah, well, we've talked about Robert Frost's poetry, but in terms of the ranking of the different modes of writing, I think poet is near the top of your list.
Hey, poetry is the prince of the literary arts, you know? It's at the very top because it's language refined to its apex of memorability. And so I'm interested in poetry as memorability and poetry as something you live by. These are the words you live by. These words stay in your brain and guide your life. That's what I'm interested in.
And it's a living language. Traditionally, it wasn't always even committed to writing. It was something that was shared and spoken and remembered.
Yes, shared and remembered. That's why a little book on Robert Frost, 16 poems, is all about poems that you could memorize. And it seems to me a crucial thing, poetry and memory.
So there are tools for teaching as well and imparting wisdom. And I'm wondering, in your 50 years of teaching, what that might have given you as a performer of words, even if it's not always poetry, just getting in touch with, oh, there's the audience. This is that sense of language in space and sound and a physical living language.
Well, I have a little book called The Art of Teaching that I wrote many years ago. And my main point in that book is that teaching is a kind of theatrical performance. And that, you know, when you come onto a classroom, you're stepping onto a stage and you're inhabiting a persona. And just like a persona in a play, and remember that persona means in Latin, persona, the voice sounding through the mask. In ancient Greek literature, if you wanted to put on a Greek play, there were a set number of personae, characters, Clytemnestra, Zeus, whatever. And you went to the keeper of the masks and you said, oh, give me that one and that one and that one. And you made a play. And then the actors came out on the stage and they spoke through the mask. And that's per through sona, the voice sounding through the mask. And so I think that whenever we step out into public, we are putting on a mask of sorts, and the teacher especially is inhabiting a persona. And so I was, you know, over the years, I think, refining my various teaching personae and learning how to communicate through those means. I mean, the industry is always going through its ups and downs. This is a particularly difficult moment for trying to get a book published. It's not easy for a young writer, a novelist, or a poet to find a publisher, and persistence is what's required. And if the work is good, eventually you'll find a publisher and an agent. But if you keep the focus on the work, that's my best advice that I tell all my students. Keep your mind on your work. So I'm writing books that I would like to read myself. That's really what I'm trying to do. But I'm at this stage of the game, too, now that I'm retired, I'm trying to just really write what pleases me, what interests me, with never any thought to audience or commercial or anything like that. Just what pleases me to write, because I feel like it's something I want to say on paper before I kick the bucket.
I want to ask about, in talking about the future of writing and literature, we've seen what for me is a disturbing emergence of AI. Before that, we had the digital revolution, which of course threatened journalism. We've seen newspapers in a dire state, not having a business model to survive. Now we see the lure of AI, where I see advertisements come up. They say, type in 30 seconds, we'll write your book for you. People are using it. People are forming relationships with it, like virtual boyfriends, spouses, using it. It's coming as an interface between communications, how we communicate with our own imagination. And your body of work is such that it's a crystallization, the fruits of a life, the wisdom that comes from walking the earth. And this is wisdom that's just been sourced from everywhere and has never walked the earth. It comes from a black box. So what are your reflections on that, and you know, how it's changing our imaginations and our way of life and seeing the world?
Well, I think I can tell in 2 seconds when something is written by AI or there's a real personal voice. And so I think there's never been a more desperate need or thirst for the personal voice. So I do think that people are going to be looking for the personal voice, and they're going to want to read. That's why you go back to Camus, Tolstoy, even Gore Vidal in his essays. AI couldn't write a Gore Vidal essay. You know, it couldn't happen. And that's because the wit, the depth of knowledge, it takes a lifetime to shape a voice. And so to find it and shape it, to work with it, to develop it, it's developing an individual voice. I mean, Borges, my God, you'd recognize a sentence by Borges wherever you ran into it. It's nothing else like it on this earth. AI could not write a Borges story. I love humor. I like playfulness. I love telling stories, and I love hearing stories, which is why I read. Well, I mean, my Christianity for a start, but what I love about Jesus is his absolute focus on the marginalized, the poor. And the Christianity is all about self-emptying. The word is that St. Paul uses is kenosis. You empty the self. Let God fill you up. You know, and I think people, that's why the churches are, I think religion is coming back. I can see my own church here. Every week we get more and more numbers. People are desperate for some connection to the spiritual life. And especially in the age of this terrible president, Trump, my God.
Well said.
You know, I mean, Trump is such a idiotic, narcissistic child. He's, you know, a four-year-old running the world. Imagine having not just a four-year-old, but a crazy four-year-old running the world. We're in bad shape. And so people, I think, are yearning for, and he also, Trump has no spiritual depth. I mean, he's the farthest thing from that. I mean, the poor man, he is a sad, sad case. And he's in front of us every day, and that voice is on the airwaves. I think people are going to be rushing toward real voices, rushing toward spiritual engagements. And I think that we are in a very crisis moment in the world culture, not just, I mean, Trump and but everywhere, Viktor Orban, you know, in Italy, Maloney, everywhere you look, there's a kind of a strange, disembodied voice where people are being lost. And the people on the margins are being lost. I mean, we're a world of immigrants, not just a nation of immigrants. I mean, everybody is an immigrant. Everybody came from somewhere. Nobody came from nowhere. I have a book called Promised Land, 13 books that changed America. And it's kind of an intellectual history of America. It's told through 13 key voices. And there is a whole chapter in there on the Federalist Papers. If you look at all those great founding fathers. And Gore Vidal once said, we were founded by some of the smartest people who ever lived, but he said they disappeared very quickly. We've never seen them again. I mean, America has a rich intellectual tradition, and you would never know it listening to Trump or his gang, his cabinet, who are really just bobbleheads.
Yes, and it's so interesting when you read back at the founding fathers, was they were so educated and they were going back to foundational texts. Cicero, they were really well versed in the classics in a way that you would find it impossible to imagine. They all seem to be familiar, and the Stoic tradition, and it was so interesting, heavily flawed, of course, but we were talking about majority of them slave owners. And yet they had this knowledge and they kind of were basing a lot of their philosophy and politics on that.
Yeah, I mean, Thomas Jefferson was an exquisitely educated mind. I mean, the slave owning was all a horrible part of the era, you know? So, you know, we are always caught in our own eras and times. And at least Jefferson, Madison, John Adams, these people were tremendously sophisticated, and they had read the classics, the Roman and Greek classics. They knew their Plato. They knew their Cicero. They knew Aristotle.
Yeah, only recently I learned in writing about Franklin that when Philadelphia was full of mud and shanty, he translates Cicero when he's 37 years old, translates into English and publishes A Well-Spent Life. And he does that with no financial background, but starts making money on it. And that's when Franklin begins to think of himself not just as a printer, but as a publisher. Thank God he had some faith that the new nation was interested in classics. And he writes the introduction, and it's a beautiful book.
Yeah, his memoir, his autobiography is one of the classic American books. An amazing book.
And so Cicero, I mean, going back to your Italian heritage, how do you feel that has informed your voice, your sense of history? How is the voice of your parents and your family, how has that gone into forming the writer who you are today?
You know, I spent a lot of time in Italy. I spent a lot of time in Rome, Amalfi, north of Italy. And I've read sort of deeply in some of the Italian writers. I mean, going back to the classical writers, I would say early on, I was profoundly influenced by writers such as Horace and Catullus, particularly. And of course, you know, Cicero is one of the great thinkers, philosophers, political philosophers. And I love his work. And so, and of course, going up through, I've spent a lot of time reading Dante. I mean, to me, he's like one of the great poets up there with Shakespeare. So, you know, Dante, Shakespeare, these great poets are great for a reason. I mean, they're astonishing because they're connected with the spirit in a way. It's never about them. It's about their connection to the spirit.
I just want to ask about when you're writing, are you writing into a place where you're almost, you're just like feeling, it's like an instinctual place where you're channeling
voice? Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm only writing well when I'm invisible to myself. Yeah, I have to become nobody. As I'm nobody, who are you, said Emily Dickinson. I have to become nobody and then nothing to be able to embody this something that seems to me to be coming from the spirit. And, you know, if it's language that's real, it won't have anything to do with Jay Perini. I'm interested in only being a vehicle, if I can be, for anything that's possibly true or interesting. Historiography, it's a sub-genre of history, really. It really is. And so in running through Steinbeck's life, you're really going through the history of the United States of America in the 20th century, late 19th century. Right. I think as far as creativity goes, being alert to opportunities is important. Really alert to. So when I came across those journals related to Tolstoy, I could see, aha, here we go. This is something I could work with. So I'm always trying to stay alert to what might be something I can make use of and turn into something.
And in your novels too, but in your poetry particularly, there's a great sense of place and inspiration from nature. And so, I mean, could you share your reflections about the wonder of the natural world, your personal memories? And I guess as you think about the future, the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Well, everything I've done has come out of a sense of place. Most of the people I write about are obsessed with where they live and the natural world around them, and they're inspired by nature, becomes a symbol of the spirit, right? So every natural sign in the world, a tree, a rock, a bird, is somehow emblematic of a larger, complicated universe. And so I think young people should get out into the world, go hiking in the woods, sit under a tree, listen, don't try to be somebody, try to be nobody, and then something will happen. Shakespeare had a perfect ear, and he was listening, he was watching the world, he was watching nature. He was watching how people interact. He was interested in the politics of the day. He was watching, listening, waiting. So watch, listen, and wait.
That's so true. Well, thank you, Jay Perini, for sharing your creative journey and insights into great lives, the American icons, the power of poetry, art, and the humanities. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you very much, Mia.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.